Welcome, everyone, to this week's episode of the Perceptive Podcast here at Game Wisdom. I am Josh Spicer, the owner and lead writer. Join me this week, Game Wisdom site designer and artist for Smuggy Games, Kenneth Olm.
Hey there.
And a new guest this week, another friend of mine that I played with, Rob.
How's it going?
Good, how are you doing?
Good, thank you.
Since this is your first time on, we'll start with just some general introduction, so you know who you are and what type of games you like.
Sure. My name is Rob. I've just turned 30. And I have absolutely no connection to the game industry beyond playing, but I've played since I was 4 or 5, so like mid-80s.
That's just about me, too. I've been playing since, 1988 was when I first started. Oh, I get to feel old yet again on this cast.
It's all right. I'm sure we have a large swath of ages, so I feel terrible about it. And, hey, it's funny that we are now having second and third generation gamers in this world. It's cool.
Yeah, it's crazy just to see how much industry has grown in the last, 20, 25 years.
Yeah, and now we're getting that problem with everyone wanting to become game designers and developers and a flood of too many games, so.
And issues with, companies trying to copyright things, but we'll talk about that in a little bit more detail in a few minutes.
Yeah.
So, Rob, what type of games do you normally like to play?
Well, I play a pretty wide variety, but I really like... I guess I like a lot of games that are like what I grew up with. So I really like 2D platformers. I really like RPGs, both Western and Japanese, but I'm really picky about them. And these days I play a lot more small indie games than AAA ones. Not because I think they're bad or anything. I have the worst gaming ADD in the world. I just don't have the patience to go through a 30-hour game.
Yeah, I'm getting that way myself. I've got games like Crusader Kings on my list. I got Kerbal Space Program, games that you could spend hundreds of hours playing.
I don't have the attention span.
Yeah, I can't sit there and play them, especially when you have to spend hours just trying to learn the game. That's what really gets me. I don't mind playing a game for 20-30 hours if it's easy to get into, but if I have to spend 5 to 10 hours just reading tutorials and watching videos, I'll blank out long before I get to a point that I can understand it.
And we always discuss that, a game should integrate, through tutorials and gameplay together to teach the player how to actually enjoy it,
And that is a talent that only a few companies really have been able to express. Companies like Valve, Nintendo, are probably the two that come to my mind almost immediately with how they integrate their tutorials directly into the level design. So it doesn't feel like you're being taken out to learn the game, you're basically learning the game as it goes along.
The same problem as any sort of education or edutainment is what they call it, is that they can't mix them or merge them together correctly. It's always, here's education, here's gameplay, back and back. It needs to be seamlessly put together.
Some games do that really well, but even then, I get annoyed sometimes if I go play a game again that I haven't played in a while. And then I have to go through all this tutorial junk before I can get to the game that I already know how to play.
Yeah, I think that level of busy work that a lot of games have, especially those that try to bridge the gap between younger and older audiences. So there's that hint that there's a lot of complexity there, but you have to wade through a lot of basic tutorial stuff to get at that point.
I think we might be dancing around the big Nintendo-shaped elephant in the room here.
Yeah, and of course Nintendo hasn't had a good last 2 weeks either. They've been reporting their shares have been lowest. People have been contemplating whether or not they're going to move to smartphones. That's been the big debate I've been hearing lately.
I think that would be, even though that would make money doing that, I think it would be counter to what because their money comes from mobile already, from their mobile devices. So yeah, they're going to be directly funding their competitors, even though it would be a bigger swath and more opportunities for it to sell. It would hurt them in the long run.
Yeah, the big problem, I think, with Nintendo really comes down to just their third-party support. And that's, unfortunately, a problem that it's sort of a lose-lose for them. They can't attract new developers to the platform because why would you just work on the Wii U when you can have, a much larger audience with the Xbox and PlayStation? And then you have the only other option would be then to basically buy these third-party developers, but then you're, of course, spending that much more money to acquire these studios and maybe put out one or two extra games each year.
I think you lost me a little at the end. I'm not sure I understand what you mean about the strategy.
Well, I mean that if they want to get more developers on board, the only other option would be to basically buy them outright or buy majority control. And that would, of course, require a lot more money, a lot more basically throwing money to hopefully get a little bit more return at the end. Like, it's very hard for them to basically attract developers who willingly want to make games for the Wii U.
Right. I mean, they've kind of missed the boat on a lot of the modern trends like HD and online play. I read an interview or a segment of an interview with a Wii U developer who said that they were writing a memo that referenced Xbox Live and PSN, or it was a group discussion or something like that. And they talked to like an internal Nintendo development team, and they were told that, you know, we don't know what these things are because none of our people use them. Can you give us an explanation? And it really kind of makes a lot clearer about what's been going on at Nintendo lately.
Yeah.
How can you just miss these massive, massive things? How can none of your people ever use them?
Yeah, that's like almost like cold drinking the Kool-Aid type thing that you never, no one in Nintendo knows what Xbox Live is or how it works, especially when you're trying to compete against the two biggest competitors in your industry.
Yeah, it really, it kind of makes it very clear why Nintendo Online Everything sucks.
But they're not the only company that has that kind of problem of being in their own bubble. If you look at, and I like to bring it up like I always do, but Final Fantasy XIV, the new director brought up that the reason why the game seemed so archaic was because these people that loved 11 only saw what they did in the past and what EverQuest did originally, and just kind of just wanted to bounce off that, but not look at the trends and all the other games that have come out after that or since. So they were creating the game in a bubble. And in fact, what they did was, and this is, I think, that they were actually told to do, was to make a lot of the smaller mechanics of the games, like, what's it called? Like gathering materials and mining and fishing on, and make the games even like more, I guess, time consuming, right? Because like if you click on like a shiny thing and you are gathering some sort of like leaf or you're gathering some sort of mineral, you know, you just get it, right? But
right.
Here you have to, it takes like a minute, and every minute you have to hit like something right at the exact time. And if you do it just correctly, you'll get it. But if you don't, you'll miss it and you have to wait another minute. So it could increase, you know, it can increase many folds if you're trying to actually craft something, because maybe you would get that one item every 1 or 5 minutes, but you need, I don't know, 1,000 of it. So that was their concept, was to lengthen a lot of these mini parts of it. Also give cooldowns to levels too. So you could only level after a certain amount of time. But you know what I mean? It's pretty ridiculous. So what they did was they took the system that was already a bit old and definitely outdated, and they made it even more outdated. Go ahead.
The one thing that everyone hates about MMOs is grinds. And they're seriously trying to make it worse on purpose. That was
their plan. Well, the concept was they'll spend more time in their world and less time in others, and also it'll increase. I don't know. Like, their thinking was really.
How is that
there.
Even a benefit?
I don't know. I don't know why. But again,
yeah, like if I'm paying you $15 a month or whatever it is, really the ideal case for you is that I spend 0 minutes in your game and you spend no resources on me.
Well, the concept is they made everything seem like a chore. Like, you're talking about how you hate the grind. Well, they up the grind till tenfold. Like, example, and I always discuss this too, but the marketplace. When you have like you played World of Warcraft.
Yeah,
you just go to a marketplace, you buy it, you buy something, that's it, you get the item. But in this game, you actually have to find the person. You have to physically go through the world, by the way, that has no sort of fast travel, no like chocobo or anything. You have to walk there, and you rock at the slowest speed possible, by the way. You have to find this person in a mass of other people. So, good luck. Again, a system that they thought was, quote, realistic. I'm like, no.
Is there any way to search, or do you have to look through everybody's inventory and see if they have it?
I believe you search, and then it gives you like a glowing, like a little like line or like sparkle line to follow to find the person.
Oh, well, that's realistic.
Yeah, I know. I think honestly, that's how the Bazaar worked in EverQuest 1. There was if you ever played EverQuest, how they did their marketplace was there was a zone called the Bazaar, and you would just have like ton of people just standing around, and you'd have like their own like, I don't know, big mules that they would put items on, and then you had to go find them, and you had to like search the item, and then it would pick a little trail. And also, you can never look forward, you had to look up or down, because you would lag out if you were to stare at somebody. But I mean, that was the same kind of system they put in place there, you know? But instead of having it in one zone, it's in multiple zones. You have to cross multiple zones of nothing. to get your like item.
I guess I have another question about this. If I want to sell an item and I'm selling it in the bazaar, do I have to have my character physically in the bazaar? Like, did it stop me from playing the game?
Yeah, physically have to have a character in the bazaar.
So you actually have to do nothing but stand around the crowded zone. That's
what people did was they would just put it on during nighttime and then they would go to sleep. And would just leave their thing on all day. In fact, when I was playing the game, I was really young, so I would actually have to ask older friends to, hey, can I put my stuff on your account and you sell it for me, because I can't have a computer on all night. So that's what they would do. But yeah, it's again, it's they were making the game in a bubble, going back to your original concept, what we're discussing. They made the game in a bubble. They made it based, I mean, they made a great game for the time, 11, right? Because it definitely did compete with EverQuest, and they did a better job in a lot more respects. However, you know, what, 10 years later, 8 years later, things change, you know?
Yeah.
And you can't make your systems worse to lengthen your game.
I guess I don't really have a good concept of the release timeline. Was FF11 out before WoW?
Yes.
Okay.
I would believe, I think it was like EverQuest, like 11, and then WoW after that. And WoW just took everything EverQuest was and made it way better. And then EverQuest 2 came out around the same time, and they made everything way worse because they went for realism, which was a mistake, because we didn't have the technology to make it realistic. So,
what do you mean by realism?
That's what I mean. Like, when you create a game, when you create a style, you can either go for, you know, the reason people go for stylistic, like extreme proportions and stuff like that, is that it lasts longer, like a longer period of time. Like, you have a sense of, you remember it better, right? But if you go for realistic, there's that uncanny valley issue. And also, at the time, realistic was rubber people, right? That's no good. And that's exactly what people got. It was just a lot of really, really bad textured, like muddy looking rubber people, along with a world that definitely, okay, so one benefit I would say EverQuest 2 over 14, which came out like a couple years ago, is that at least like landmarks were a lot more memorable, like where you were. Because the problem with 14 is everything was so such a large expanse. It was so like epic, they would quote, or huge, a huge world, but a huge world of nothing, of plains of nothing, just a bunch of slopes, some grass here and there, but you couldn't figure out where you were. Even in real life, there's like, what do you call it? Like cornerstones, stuff that you could, I mean, not cornerstones, but landmarks that you could recognize, you figure out your way, but in that world, there really isn't. It's just a bunch of nothing. And you can only walk through it. It's horrible. But let me tell you again, everything I'm saying is in the past, right? It was the first year of the game being released. They actually destroyed the entire world, fired their staff, hired a new director, and they remade the game, and I heard it was very good.
Yeah, I have a couple of friends playing it now. They like it.
But, like, the old game was an affront to humanity, I say. It was the most exploitive pile of, like, time-wasting crap I've ever seen or demoed or, I mean, beta in my life. And that map system, God, that map system, I'm having nightmares right now about it. Flashbacks. It's like Vietnam.
So, I've largely sworn off MMOs at this point.
Yeah, you know, I'm actually the same kind of way. I really was into MMOs for a while. And but the new video for EverQuest Next looks amazing because they use a voxel-based system similar to Minecraft, but they make it realistic. Think of it as like Minecraft on steroids. And the characters are really stylized. And they also, don't forget, because their game's been out for so long, EverQuest and EverQuest 2, they have a huge set of lore, too. And a big fan base, too. And I think they've learned a lot. Like, they're the masters of it now, by this time.
Well, my biggest problem with them now isn't anything like that. My biggest problem with them is sort of inherent to the genre. A single-player game, you can log in for, like, you know, 15 minutes or a half an hour or whatever, and do whatever it is you want to do. But with an MMO, you say you have like a group of 5 people for a dungeon, or 10 people or 25 people or whatever for a raid. And a thing that takes, in theory, half an hour to do takes way longer because somebody's running late, this person has to go to the bathroom. Just trying to get everyone to walk in the straight line takes forever. And even no matter how much you try, trying to satisfy those requirements and get things done, it takes an unacceptable toll on social life for me.
Yeah,
I think it's understandable. I think that's very clear. As you get older, you have less and less time. But obviously we don't know exactly how they're going to do their systems yet, but it looks like everything's a lot more action-based, so I don't think you're going to need a party of like 100 or 40 or whatever for raids. But we'll see as more videos actually come out for EverQuest Next. But I think that they're really, to me, the next-gen MMO that we've all been waiting for, because we thought Star Wars was going to be something new. But it was just Warcraft with a skin, which was terrible.
yeah.
But the EverQuest Next was like, they're doing a lot of really interesting thing. And one other great thing is traversal. They have a lot more interesting ways they do traversal. In terms of, like, they do like a parkour thing where you can run and slide and stuff like that, which is way better than what we all expect with MMO controls now.
Yeah.
So it actually makes traversing fun, which is something I'm excited for. And I was reading there's an AMA on Reddit right now for John Smedley, who is the president at SOE and has been president of SOE for the beginning, all the way back to EverQuest 1. So he has a good sense of the whole business and structure and everything. And he confirmed bards are going to be in EverQuest Next, which is my class. Because I love picking any class in an MMO that's worthless. So I play the bard because it's hilarious.
I'm horrible. My favorite thing to do in MMO is annoy people. So I played a rogue in WoW because there is nothing more infuriating than getting killed by someone you couldn't see.
Right. So you like the PvP system?
No, I actually hate PvP. I don't enjoy most of the objective based stuff in MMOs. Maybe I just haven't played ones with good PvP. But if you play World of Warcraft on a PvP server, and you're just stalking some guy. And I'm not talking about squashing newbies, someone of your own level or whatever. And it infuriates people to just get sapped or backstabbed out of nowhere because they had no way of knowing you were even coming.
Yeah, that's like, I guess that goes for like TF2. When you play against a spy, you never played against a spy class before, and you get stabbed. It makes you paranoid and scared, and you get angry, or you go, or what you do what they want you to do, which is go pyro, right?
Yeah, I love TF2, and I'm really bad at TF2. So I play pyro like 80% of the time because at least I can spy check.
You think you can spy check, but that's why I have a longevity set, which is a bicycle, which allows me to just, you know, you can fire me up all you want, and I can shoot you twice and kill you. So
that's the thing. I don't have to kill you. I just have to let the rest of my team know you're there.
Ah, but if you're the spy, you shouldn't be going in a group of people anyways. unless you have the right set. Like if you really get people unaware and you have a Saharan set and you get the first stab, then you could probably do the rest. But again, I'm going into details that I don't need to go into. But the point is that it makes people, it's super satisfying to be a spy, and it makes people super paranoid, which is great because sometimes you can just be invis or you're watching from a ledge and watch everyone just go crazy, just going crazy. And there's something called a dead ringer, which allows someone to die once and then come back and you hear that quirker, quirker, quirker sound. Like, it's even louder than before. They made it louder. It's horrible. But as soon as they hear it, the team goes nuts. Everyone goes nuts. They just go insane. Like, somewhere. There's somewhere.
Yeah. I want desperately to be a good spy player, and I'm just not. I'm trash at spy.
Oh, yeah. You should see, use some of my, there was a set called Saharan Set, which is one of my favorite things, and I almost quit the game because they changed it. It's a set where you have a knife that takes people's faces, but you can't disguise yourself. And you have the dead ringer where you can't turn invisible. And then you need the Lestrange, which is the weakest pistol in the game, the weakest melee weapon, I say, in the game, with the most inaccurate too. You shoot someone like point blank and you still miss. That's how weak it is. But when you hit somebody, it increases your cloak so you can go back faster. So you can dead ringer into infinity. But it's a super, super, like, high skill, high reward type of set, which I love, because to have that set, you'd also be lower the sound of your dead ringer, which is awesome, because so you could dead ringer almost next to someone and they can hear it and you could kill them. But that's the beauty of it, because you need the first, you're worthless unless you get your first disguise. You need to stab one person to go on your killing spree. So if you don't get it, you know, you can't do your mega chance and stuff like that. And I have actually a lot of videos of me going through like killing like a whole team or getting like a 60 kill streak with just that Saharan set because it's so powerful and amazing. But they change it now where if you have the set, when you taunt someone, dust is around you and that's it. What? That was it. They changed it. They eliminate all sets from the game. And now you have special calling cards and kill somebody if you taunt, which is so stupid. So they're never bringing it back, and it makes me sad every time I use it. It's just not the same. So
I really like TF2, but I actually get annoyed that stuff like that isn't available to new players. I know that you guys recently wrote about free-to-play and pay-to-win kind of setups. While I still like TF2, it's not the items in there aren't just cosmetic, and to me, that's the problem.
Oh, no, you could, but they're like, first of all, they're fast drops and easy trades. People get tons of them. So you can always ask on a server, like, does anyone have this kind of item? I'm sure someone will trade you.
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. I don't like jumping through those hoops.
But the thing is that all the items and weapons and stuff have different, like, they have different strengths and weaknesses too.
They're side
great. Right. They're not all benefits. Like the candy cane for the scout isn't really that great.
So that's usually true, but there are definitely some items that have only positives.
Okay, well, there was one item recently, and I'll for any TF2 players out there, that was really broken. It was called the Short Circuit.
Yeah, I have one.
It was an item that no one used. Like, no one used it because it was so worthless, because it would take so much metal, and it was so slow, and, like, having a pistol or a Wrangler would be way better. But recently they changed it, so the Short Circuit did damage, too. Like, it did damage before, but now it took less metal, like 5 metal.
Yeah.
And it was really, really, really fast. So not only could no missiles hit you, but you could chase people down and kill them. It was actually more damaging than a flamethrower. Crits, by the way. So I would just be running full hog at a team with the shark and kill the whole team. Nothing could stop me. Because I would just kill them, take their metal, and keep doing it to someone else. And they couldn't stop me. And people would shoot rockets and like spam me, and nothing would hit me because all of them would disappear. I'd just keep running at them.
Yeah.
And if they had, like, say, like it's a soldier and he has like a buff banner, he wouldn't be able to shoot me or kill me. He had to go melee on me. And he'd just die if he got close. So it was just the most insane thing. So you'd see servers with like 3 or 4 just engineers running around with a little Short Circuit, laying out mini sentries and just running after you. There's nothing you could do. It was the best thing. But yeah, anyways, but that was an exploit again. So that's what happens when you introduce any new item or any change. You never know the outcome of what's going to happen. Predict how the community is going to use it.
Yeah, that kind of balancing is always really hard. They should have
did a lot more testing in beta on the beta servers before they brought it live to the real servers. So that mistake, but whatever. It was fun while it lasted for a week.
Yeah, I'm seeing a similar reaction on the game I'm playing, that Marvel Puzzle Quest game.
Sell that game to me. Why do you play that 24 hours a day?
It's basically Puzzle Quest, but with different characters. You basically create teams, and they have a wide variety of, like, tournaments you can play that gets you more stuff. But as I said last week, it is such a monetized game. It's not like a game like League of Legends or Team Fortress, where there's enough, they give you enough as a free player that you don't feel pressure to spend. With them, they're still trying to get around ways to get you to keep spending money on that game. So they just announced they're going to be doing an update on a lot of the characters, and one of the problems that they're running into, and sort of like a backlash with the players, is that they're going to be nerfing two characters, Wolverine and Thor, who are considered a top tier, even though they have like a ranking system, like in an RPG, so 1-star is normal, 2-star rare, and so on. So these two characters are considered 2-star, so they're a step above, and their skills are so powerful that pretty much everyone uses them, to the point that it's, you know, completely imbalanced in that sense that pretty much all the time the most popular option. So, of course, that means people were trying to focus on them, which means spending money on them. And
right, now people are going to be mad because their toys getting nerfed.
Exactly, and they just nerfed another character a week ago who, in order to get him to a point of pretty much all-powerfulness, you either need to be really, really lucky, or you need to spend at least $100 just to get him to that point. So, of course, the people who want to be competitive spent that money, no questions asked, and then they just nerfed them down to hell, basically. But that's always been that problem with free-to-play games, is the difference between being good towards the many or to the few. Do you make the game more towards your whales, the guys who have the big bucks, who want those overpowered $50 items? Or do you try to go for a longer-lasting game, but that doesn't have as many overpowered nature or doesn't demand you to spend money?
I think if you want your game to last, it has to feel fair to people.
Exactly.
Which means you can't do that.
Yeah, I think that is pretty much like the beauty of what Riot Games has done with League of Legends, is that they've made it so friendly. You don't need to spend money. I know people, I think I probably talked to a few of the guys on Mumble, who they spent money on that game just to give support to Riot, because they felt, you know, they were taking advantage of them for playing the game for so many hours without paying any money towards it.
Well, you know, with that game, even though you don't have to spend any money, and it's true you don't, I actually buy things for friends, what my problem is. So during the holidays, I spend like $40 or $50 on League, not for myself, but for friends like all around the world that I can't actually send a real gift to. So I just sent them a skin. And like, I think that this is one of the best things about virtual items is that like, you never want to buy it for yourself. You don't want to, it will feel like it's a waste of money. But if someone gives it for you, it's like euphoric. You're like, yes, I always wanted to get this, but I never had the balls to actually spend the money to get it. So giving that feeling to other people is great. And that's exactly what I did. And instead of spending hundreds of dollars and multiple dollars on shipping and stuff, I just gave people skins. And they enjoyed it just the same as I would have got them a real life gift.
I don't want to oversell Riot there. You can get all the characters in League of Legends from playing the game, but it takes a really long time. And there's a lot of incentive to buy characters. I do think they've done a pretty good job of not deliberately unbalancing things. Or, you know, something like that, you're always kind of worried they're going to make this new character overpowered for the first couple of weeks, so the people who buy them will have an advantage. But I don't think they've really done that deliberately. It's happened once or twice, but
yeah, like you don't get that sense of malice or that sense of them trying to squeeze as much money out of the player base that you see in a lot of the more monetized or shadier free-to-play games out there. Stuff like the Farmvilles, and stuff, and one we'll get to in a few minutes. Before we move on, I do want to bring this back for 1 minute to Nintendo and what we talk about with Squaresoft, or Square Enix, what they're called now. And it is interesting how a lot of these older development companies are having that trouble adapting. And I think part of that is sort of that sense that, you know, they are stuck in their ways. The old adage of it ain't broke, don't fix it. I mean, when you see Nintendo make the umpteenth Mario game, Zelda, Metroid, and when these games are big sellers, why should they experiment? So we're now sort of seeing the negative side of that these days, with Nintendo struggling to branch their identity out beyond just being the guys who just make Mario all the time.
Well, actually, I mean, making Mario is working really well for them. Yeah. It's one of the things that sells consistently.
The problem is that there's going to be fatigue, and there's already fatigue. Think about the new Super Mario series. The new... just saying new makes it... because it's not new, it's never been new. Well, it's always new in the 80s, but it's there, and they've been making tons of it, and they've been making it for both the 3DS and the Wii U.
The only thing that really bothers me about that is that they're not very good. Yeah. If they were more of the original Mario style and they were good games, I would be all over that. I love Mario.
Well, they're trying to replicate Super Mario 3 with all those games. And for the most part, they do hit it, but each of the new versions of it, it's just small iterations, like maybe you can turn to gold. Maybe you can have this certain suit. That's pretty much all it is. It's a game that you could probably just patch, right? Or a game you could just add DLC to. You don't need to buy another $50 game for almost the same exact experience.
You don't even know how much Super Mario World DLC I would buy.
Yeah, that would be good.
Yeah. How many mushrooms could you purchase? <That'd be awesome. laughs>
All right, so after all that, let's move on and talk about some news and what we've sort of been dancing around in terms of social games. And the piece of news that I want to bring up is regarding the copyright issue that's happening between Candy Crush Saga and the Banner Saga, or sort of happening. Basically, for those of you who don't know, the developers or the publishers of Candy Crush Saga, I believe they're called King, filed a trademark to trademark the word candy, and they've also filed it for the word saga. And for their line of reasoning, they're trying to defend their property from people who would clone it, which, as we all know, Candy Crush Saga is a Match 3 clone by itself. So
it's Bejeweled, yeah, basically, right?
You know, that there's that lovely degree of hypocrisy there. But now that they're trying to copyright the word Saga, now they're sort of going after the Banner Saga, which is developed by Stoic. And these were the guys we've talked about on previous casts. They did a Kickstarter last year for their game. I think they've been actually developing it for years now. So it's pretty much become a PR fiasco for King. Today, I believe, a company stepped forward saying that King cloned one of their games when they decided not to go with King as their publisher. And King said, "We never did that," but then they took the game down, you know, almost immediately. But now...
Is that the Pac-Man thing? I haven't actually been following the Pac-Man thing much, but if I understand correctly, I read a Gama Sutra article on that today. And if I have it right, they said they were going to take it down, but it's actually still up.
Good. That's even better.
I might be wrong about that.
That's true. I believe it's still up.
And this whole issue gets into one of the murkier sides of copyright and IP protection. I believe, now I'm not a lawyer, so, you know, take everything I'm going to say with a grain of salt. But from what I've read in the past, there's this issue that if you do have a copyright to something, you need to defend that or you can lose it. Now, I'm not 100% sure of that. Have either of you guys heard of that?
I'm not a lawyer, but I believe that is correct. I'm not sure if it applies specifically to trademarks or if it's all IP.
So this is one of those cases where, on one hand, King does have the right to defend themselves. They are a multi-million dollar company, even though they make a clone, you know, very crappy clone, which I've only played once or twice. But on the other hand, for them to pursue companies like the Banner Saga or anyone who puts Saga in their title, that just comes off as, I think a lot of people are calling them a bully these days.
I mean, I don't think it passes the sniff test, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, trademarking basic words, just sort of instinctively we reject it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, I mean, if you look at the Banner Saga versus Candy Crush Saga, I mean, I can't see any sense or semblance of a copyright infringement. And the Banner Saga, I think, has been in development longer than Candy Crush, but I don't think they pursued the copyright until very recent. But I'm not 100% sure.
If I have the sequence right, this whole thing was kicked off by Stoic filing a trademark claim for the Banner Saga, and then King filing a notice of opposition to it.
Yep. And this is similar to a case that happened a few years ago where I believe his name was Tim Longdell, who he basically filed a copyright for the word Edge. And he basically went on this just insane spree of lawsuits for, I think it was 2011, 2010, where any company that had the word Edge in their title, he would file for a lawsuit against them. So he went,
how'd that go?
Not that well. He went after EA, I think, for Mirror's Edge. He went after someone else. And he was actually on the board of directors for the IGDA at the time. And because of that, they all basically kicked him out for trying to do this.
Yeah, he sounds like a pretty crazy guy, but it does touch upon a very messed up system that we have, which is, you know, we have these copyright trolls that exist or patent trolls that exist out there dedicated just patenting something or copyrighting something and waiting for the right time to strike. And then they just attack. And some people, like especially smaller people, not big companies, get scared and pay things off, you know?
And Stoke's response is they don't really care about, they're just going to keep going along with the Banner Saga.
And that's the right response for the most part, because I get the claim is ludicrous, you know? I think it can easily be fought, because the term Saga is so general that I think they'll have a lot of legs to actually fight back. But the question is, are they willing to put the money up?
Yeah.
You know?
That's
what the other side is hoping for.
Is it actually going to be a court battle? I don't really know how this works. I mean, is it that, or is it just like a ruling from the patent and the trademark office?
That I don't know, unfortunately.
I believe, wouldn't they give them like a cease and desist kind of thing? Like, stop making this game?
Well, they already filed a notice of opposition, but I don't know where it goes from there.
I'll believe the courts then after that. They don't stop.
And
if it's a valid stop.
Yep. And this type of issue is just, as Ken just mentioned a few minutes ago, it's just yet another in the long string of just problems with the copyright and trademark law. We had issues, of course, with the whole thing with Nintendo trying to claim, what was it, free use on YouTube videos from Nintendo. And, you know, who gets the money from that? Are they stealing from Nintendo? And...
I remember this.
I just remember the term. And a lot of the problems is that the copyright system is still pretty much years behind how things have transitioned to a digital age. There's still that whole controversy over, do we really own our games, or are we just owning, you know, licenses to play them? And I know the European Union rule that we do in fact own our games and we are allowed to sell them, but there hasn't been any type of ruling or update to those laws in the United States.
It's true. It's because it's a very, first of all, fluid thing that's going on. Things are changing here and there all the time. And you know, everyone's scared to make that first step in terms of saying that this definitive line here or there.
And the other issue, I think we talked about this before the cast, is how it's very disingenuous when you hear companies try to copyright one word. So someone trying to copyright the word candy. Now, there are cases, though, where it can be seen suitable, like such as with App or Amazon. We have these one words that the company and the brand are defined upon. But when you have, like, a 3 or 4 word title, just, you know, copyrighting one word just seems, I think, very petty. And that's where we start getting into that whole troll type situation.
Well, if I understand correctly, and again, I'm not a lawyer and I might not, it's about brand confusion, yeah. Right? If there's a risk that someone might confuse your someone else's product for yours, then you have a legitimate claim.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. And I think another part, if I remember when I looked up fair use or just copyright claim, it has to do with if someone can confuse the brand, if someone is making money or profiting from someone else's brand without any kind of pay or residuals. And I think, as you just said, if the brand, if what you're doing is can be confused, or if you're just borrowing wholesale from someone else,
I hesitate to correct you because, again, I'm not a lawyer, but I don't think that's the basis of fair use. Fair use is a defense to a copyright claim against you.
Yeah, you may be right. I think I'm thinking of the actual copyright claims that was in that article that I posted when I talked about Nintendo saying like 3-4 months ago. Fair use, I think, has to do with, is it transformative? I think education is another part of that. If you're using something for just purely education and no profit, I think you are free to use something in that regard.
I mean, there's other exceptions to, like, satire or something like that. I think we're a little out of our element with the legal talk, though.
Yeah, so let's move on now. I guess just to wrap this part up, hopefully this will... I hope that enough of these issues will happen that we can start seeing some forward momentum in terms of rewriting or adjusting the IP laws. But I've been looking at this for, you know, the last year when I heard, you know, the whole European Union deal, and I just haven't seen anything new happen in the U.S.
I'm sort of pessimistic that that's moving in a direction I'm going to be happy with.
All right, so let's move on then. So, Rob, what news do you have for us this week?
Oh, geez. The only other big controversy I remember from this week was that Indie Static thing.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how much there is to discuss. I mean, I think everyone, including that guy, agrees it was. I mean, there's nothing really to defend. It's just a terrible move all around. And he's aware of that. We should maybe explain this if you want to talk about
exactly.
It.
Exactly.
Sure. If you want to go over it, because I haven't read the update article.
If I understand it right, the guy who runs a small indie site called Indie Static messaged a developer trying to get some industry information from her. And to describe his comments as crudely sexual, I think is understating it. It's well over the line. And he's aware of that. He's apologized, and he's blamed alcoholism and depression, I think. But I mean, you can see the comments online if you go look. I know Kotaku has them up, but they're just way beyond the pale.
I didn't get to see the blurred comment either, which I really kind of wanted to see what it was. No,
the article has a link to it, and it's like however bad you're thinking it is, it's worse than that.
All right, I'll take a look at it right now.
Yeah, it's definitely something we probably wouldn't be able to mention on this podcast. And
well, I mean, they didn't blur out the one before that, and that was pretty bad.
Yeah, and then things kind of got a little bit worse when David Jaffe of God of War and Twisted Metal fame joined the discussion on Twitter. You know, saying that he didn't think of it was that bad. That got into a whole, you know, sexism debate right there. So it made a bad situation worse.
I mean, the game industry has gotten a lot of bad press for gender issues. And, I mean, it's unfortunate, but that bad press is really deserved. Yeah. Like, I mean, it's not everybody, but there's clearly a big problem in the industry.
Yeah, unfortunately. That's, so.
I just read the blurred out part of it. It's... Okay, it's bad and it's not that bad at the same time, but it's like a dorky way of someone trying to hit on you. It didn't sound that drunk, but drunk enough, I would say.
I'm gonna have to disagree. I think it's that bad. I think it is that bad.
I know it's okay. So all what I'm saying is it's okay. Yes. Okay. Let's just bottom line for me. What I'm trying to say, my viewpoint is yes, it is terrible. It is bad. It's very, very bad. I'm saying, I guess I have a lot smuttier mind because I think it could have been a lot worse what he said. But it's just pretty bad.
It's just not acceptable behavior from a grown adult.
Yeah.
No, definitely not. But I thought it was going to be some sort of something so horrendous that it would like blind me. Maybe because of my experience of looking at things on like 4chan and Reddit and all stuff like that, of like some messed up, not safe for work kind of stuff, what people say. I thought it would be a lot worse than that. But him is like a really dorky way of, like he's explaining what he wants to do to her in a really like not attractive way, like the most unsuave way possible. You know, it's pretty much like the point is whatever he was trying to do was to me offensive in terms of how he was doing it. but in terms of a professional light, it's terrible. And I think he did the right thing in stepping down, especially when it became a public light. And he's also very stupid because he's supposed to be a journalist, right? And he's supposed to be like on the cutting edge of all the social media stuff. So why are you having this chat on like Facebook, you know, something that it's definitely is logged and saved, and making these kind of statements is, I don't know what his mindset, but I really wonder his state of mind in this whole situation.
Yeah, for me, I just go back to this question in my head that when we hear about all these cases of sexist remarks and derogatory issues against women, I'm just wondering, do these people like not understand how to talk to other people? I read the comment what he wanted to do to her. I'm just thinking, in what world would you think that would be something right to say at that moment? Especially.
Oh, wait. Go ahead.
Oh, and
no, I was about to say, I just read, there's actually more I didn't read. I only read one comment. There's actually a bunch more. Oh my God, it gets worse.
Never, you were saying
never read the comments.
Oh yeah.
I just read the big long paragraph. I'm like, Jesus.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's even worse. That's like what I said, but
you found the more you found the gold at the end of the rainbow.
I wanna say in the cast, but let's just say I don't think he knows. I don't know. I just go on. What are you gonna say, Josh? I just can't fathom.
My problem is that I'm just wondering, do these people not understand social graces? Like when David Jaffe said about how that we need a checklist of things not to say or things to say or not to say to women, it's too confusing. I'm just saying they're going, yeah. What he said, that's not right in any situation. That's pretty much red flag, you don't say that. There's not really like a guess to me of whether or not, oh, is that good or bad? No, I think that would be bad in any social context, period.
I think you're right, and it's maybe a lack of socialization. People just don't understand how to act.
Mm-hmm. I have a theory, and this is not the best theory, not defending him, but try to explain his actions.
Are you sure you want to defend this?
I'm not going to defend his actions. I'm saying I'm going to explain his mindset as a drunk guy. So my theory of why he said these stupid, stupid things is because he got like a signal from her because she's talking about divorce. And he's all like, oh, well, she's single now. Better make my moves. I'm super drunk. Hey, girl, you know, I'm really good at those things that girls like. Here's on Facebook chat. Okay, have a good Sunday. And that's pretty much what happened. I'm pretty sure that was his mindset. He was just drunk. He said these awkward things. He got no response. And then at the end, he said the stupidest thing, which is like, what did he say at the very end? He said, hope you have a great Sunday. Okay. So, I mean, that's like, it sounds like a really bad joke, right? You know, like,
the aristocrats.
Or like, you think in your head, like he's making like that gamble, and his head's like, well, maybe this will work. It didn't work. Not say anything. Better awkwardly say goodbye. That was the best part of the whole thing, the way he ended it. But the rest of it is pretty offensive.
Yeah.
Because I just read all the comments now instead of just that one, and now I'm like, whoa.
And sadly, he's not the only guy who would probably say stuff like that. I mean, we could probably add 2-3 hours to this podcast just discussing some of the nastier things that comments say. And as Rob said, you never, ever want to read comments on any of these discussions. It just goes from horrible to just disturbing very quickly.
By the way, I think it would be really hilarious at the end if he said, hope you had a great Sunday, and then said a dick pic, because that would just put it nail in his coffin and just seal it. Because people just love to do that too. I don't understand that, because I know some girls that get harassed by that. People send like dick pics like it's some sort of thing that will like hypnotize you. But to me, it sounds like the most horrendous thing that could happen to me if someone sent me a dick pic. I'm like, oh my God. Like, I would burn my phone right there. But I mean, I just feel really bad because I say that, but like girls, especially some female devs, get way worse than just that, you know? Because they, not only do they get those horrible images and those insults, but they get threatened with death and rape and a bunch of other like really horrible things because of the anonymity of the internet, you know? Because they just have some random user handle and they can say whatever they want. And it just,
yeah.
You know, and I think that it's never going to get better. But go on.
And that's one of the major systemic problems, is it's really just sort of off-putting. why would you want to work in that kind of environment?
Right, and people also, and I also feel like there's people, why people argue and why Google Plus tried to change everyone to use their real names, and so things could get less toxic and less vitriol and stuff like that, because if you're using your real name, you wouldn't be saying that kind of horrendous things. But at the same time, and this is not defending anything, this is something off topic, but the reason people like 4chan is because it's so raw, because everything is so anonymous, and if you go too censored, then it becomes like a police state. So it's you need that kind of like.
I'm sorry. What?
I was saying that the benefit of it, of being anonymous on the internet is that a lot of things are more raw, right? You say whatever. There's no censor on you at all. But at the same time, it can be abused terribly. But if you get too censored and have your real name and everything out, then you're a lot more scared to actually speak the truth and be honest with your feelings. Especially because, again, it's a double-edged sword, the anonymity thing too, right? Because it can also give a lot of light to some horrendous situations without having to say your name and be a source, right? So, I mean, there's benefits and there's negatives to it. But in the end of the day, it's, to me, one of the most unfrittered freedom of press that could exist. Because a lot of news that I get now, I feel is more honest when I see it on the web than I see it on like a news channel. You know what I mean?
You've really lost me there.
What, the news channel thing or all of it?
So, I mean, I get the value of anonymity, but it's not a – where do you think it becomes a press freedom issue?
Okay, so I think the reason I brought this up is because Google did something recently to YouTube comments where
– Yeah, where you have to use your real name.
They're trying to force you to use your real name. And it's true because at one point YouTube comments were the worst things on the internet, right next to – news websites article comments,
right,
which are just as terrible. And to kind of like, we'll talk about League of Legends later, to kind of lower that vitriol and that venom, and it's just the horrible things people say, they wanted people to use their real names. And then they, and also to revive a double whammy was to revive their Google Plus as a social alternative to Facebook, right, with all these great features and everything else like that, and everything connects, etc., etc. But, you know, people didn't, when you do that kind of thing, then you'll be a lot more careful to what you say, true. But then you'll lose that value of being able to make because people are just shy, right? You know what I mean? Like, people like to make comments, but like to do it anonymously. Not everyone's going to be venomous. Not everyone's going to harass you either.
Right.
And I'm saying you lose a little bit of that freedom, like, because it's unfettered, which is beautiful and horrible at the same time. But it is still something that has broken a lot of stories and has, you know, shaped people's opinions in different aspects of ways, or changed people's minds of a different way of looking at things. Cause you're always going to have that, like that, what's it called? A hive mind acceptance answer, but then you'll have the alternatives too, right? The devil's advocate lines and something in between and all the kind of forms of discussion. But when you're using just your full name and stuff like that, you're a lot more careful because of everything that you say is a recorded. You know that it's saved forever and to the ether of the internet, but your reputation is then tied to it forever. Also, you'll never be clean, right? There's no throwaway accounts anymore. You have to use your real name and be accountable for every single thing you say. So am I saying that, you know, being vicious and horrible is a good thing? No, what I'm trying to say is that, sometimes you just want to have a separate account to discuss things without having it tied to who you really are, like your real alias. Because some people's jobs are tied entirely to reputation. And this guy that said this, you think he's going to get another job in journalism? I don't think so.
Right.
He's pretty much screwed. But, you know, not everything you say should be tied to that kind of thing, you know, to every single thing you've ever done. I don't know. But this discussion has got past games and gotten into the realm of internet freedom.
Yeah, I guess for me, I think that having that anonymity is a good thing, but at the same time, I do think that people should be held accountable for some of the things they say a lot more than what we have right now. As you just said regarding the guy, yes, his career is, you know, pretty much burning in flames right now, but at the same time, shouldn't he be, I think, for saying something like that and for going that far, do you really want someone to basically get away with that or not be held responsible? Because, I mean, yes, being completely watch and monitor is obviously a bad thing, but at the same time, if we're supposed to try to make things better, people have to be held somewhat accountable to what they say and do.
Exactly, and that's true. That's exactly true. You have to be responsible for the things you say also. But you have, there's a fine line that you have to walk in between the two, yeah, right? And I think that's what's happening right now. Eventually, and this is, goes back to that whole line with the copyright too. Someone's going to make a stand. There's going to be a fine line created eventually. But right now,
it's
the Wild West. Yeah. It's the Wild West, right?
This isn't really even an anonymity issue. This is common. Like two people who know these are two people who already know each other, talking on Facebook, mm-hmm. The entire conversation is built on a pre-existing relationship, right?
Right. And the reason what we discussed earlier, again, was spread out to something that was way more broad. But that's what happens in a podcast, blah, blah. It's just we off on a little branch, but you're right. But the way they were discussing, it sounds like they did have a previous relationship. And maybe he was making his moves or whatever. But either way, man, you're still a journalist. You're still using a public chat for the most part. And this is what I learned hard when I was a kid, you know. Whenever you talk to someone on chat, they can save that log forever, and it's never going away.
And to hell with the logging, and to hell with the making his moves. That's not how you talk to another person. Yeah. You just don't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no. Like, exactly. You don't. You shouldn't talk to someone like that. And that's, like, the most unsuave way of picking someone up. There's especially in every sort of light. And if the girl really felt offended and, you know, she came forward with it, and it's a good example of what sometimes these female devs have to go through with. But, you know, I think that the old guard is changing in time. And a lot of these old game devs will go, and there's a lot more female developers coming through the pipeline. Because, you know, I teach at a university, and I see a lot more girl devs coming through the pipeline that have taste in all variety of things and can compete just as smart and just as competitive as their male counterparts. And I think that will be, as again, the other people will go away and these new companies form, we'll see a lot more game devs coming through, female game devs.
Unfortunately, this is one of those topics that there really isn't a, you know, clean cut way to end it. But unfortunately, it's still pretty bad. But as Ken said, we're seeing very, very slowly some positive momentum, at least with more women entering the game industry and more of these stories being called out and the people pretty much getting their comeuppance for it, you know, in a sense.
Right. Just to summarize what I would say is, what this guy did was wrong, and I think that she was right to kind of bring this forth, and that, again, as time goes on, I think that the industry will get more diverse, and that's a good thing, and then we'll see a more diversity in games, which is good for everyone. But I also think that anonymity is important, but there has to be that line that's going to be drawn in the future, and that's, again, a separate thing.
I think it actually wasn't the developer that posted it. It was a friend of hers.
Whoa. Okay.
And honestly, I would kind of worry, if I were in her position, I would worry about the vitriol that would come my way if I posted it myself under my real name.
Yeah, well, there you go. Or maybe it wasn't her friend. Maybe it was her on another account, you know, a burner, like a throwaway account.
I'm taking Kotaku at its word. I really don't know.
Yeah, because, I mean, I would say that, you know, like, because then you're putting your friend at risk, right? Why not just use an anonymous account? And that's another beauty of anonymous accounts right there.
Okay.
And that's why if you see Reddit, people have throwaway comments just to comment on something that they have, like, mastery in, but it's not really something they want to attach to their main account, you know?
All right, so after that very happy-go-lucky topic, let's move on. Ken, what news do you have for us this week?
Oh, there is a new Kickstarter project that I funded. It's called Kingdom Come Deliverance. And according to their description of the game, it is a realistic single-player RPG set in medieval Europe. And everything they claim is authentic to the time, so they did a lot of research. And it's an open-world sandbox with also accurate melee combat, dungeons, and no dragons.
And how much of this exists right now?
What did you say?
How much of this exists right now?
Of the game?
Yeah.
Well, they already have a private investor that gave them a couple $1 million to create everything. Wow. And they're using the Kickstarter funds to fund the rest of it to fully realize what they actually want. You know what I mean?
Right.
They said they want to release on every single thing: PC, Xbox One, PS4, Mac, Linux, Q4 2015. Approximate game time is 30 hours to 70 hours, all 3X. I think they only have Act 1 that's created. And the reason I supported it is because I saw it on the Oculus forum, and it's going to support the Oculus Rift, so I'd say hell yes to that. So anything that, again, as everyone knows, if it's any sort of VR, I always support it. And if I can handle Final Fantasy XIV, I will do that too.
So this is still, in theory, 2 years out if everything goes according to plan, right?
Exactly. But you kind of expect that when you do any sort of Kickstarter backing, right?
Yeah, this seems like a lot of promises. We'll see how much they actually come through.
I don't know. There's a couple of Kickstarter projects that I think came through in my end. Like I did like the Shadowrun Returns. I thought that was cool.
That was good. And, yeah. But you notice that was a very they're very careful about the level of ambition in that one.
FTL was another good one that I found very enjoyable. Kickstarter projects. I think the Banner Saga so far it's pretty fun. I think they might have made a mistake with the multiplayer one. What's it called? Banner Saga Factions?
Yeah, that was the free-to-play sort of companion to the single player.
I heard that was incredibly slow battle-wise. But it did demonstrate some really cool art style. Because that's what kind of sold me on the whole Banner Saga thing, was how amazing it looked in the rotoscope style and stuff like that, that they were going through with the animation so fluid. You don't really see anything with that much attention to detail.
I haven't bought that game, and I kind of want to. Like, I don't think it's even the kind of game that I like. I really like good 2D art.
It is. If you love 2D art, it is a feast for the eyes, especially in the animations. But the cutscenes, not as much, because there's just a lot of them blinking and camera shifts to the keyboard's perspective. But in terms of in the game, it is pretty addictive. In the comment, if you like, you said you like Final Fantasy Tactics and Ogre and all that stuff like that.
I like that kind of game. I have some issues with Tactics as a game.
Yeah, well, I think you might like Banner Saga then, if that's the case. It's pretty hardcore, though. You're going to be losing characters, and it's permadeath, so...
I'm okay with that kind of thing as long as they know about it.
Never mind, it's not permadeath, so I was about to say it's not permadeath. So if they get injured, they'll come back eventually. But it is very challenging, which is why it's so fun.
I really like hard games, but I feel like I have to know what I'm getting into. Like, I played a bunch of roguelikes, and I really like them because I know that it's going to be brutal.
The way you discussed it, though, I think that you'll definitely like it. By the way, I did play, talking about rogues, I did play, what's that generational 2D platformer game?
Rogue Legacy,
right. I did try it.
I like that game.
Just like Josh. I'm in the same boat with Josh, actually, on the game.
And what's that? You like it or you don't like it?
How would you explain your viewpoint, Josh?
I guess for me, I liked it, but I didn't like fall in love with it like I did with like The Binding of Isaac or FTL. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe not so much FTL, but really The Binding of Isaac.
I actually like Rogue Legacy more than I like both of those games.
Really? I love those two more than I do Rogue. But maybe because you have a preference for 2D platformers, though, right?
Yeah, I love platformers, yeah. I also liked a lot of the silly presentation, the completely horrible perks, like the vertigo that makes you upside down, stuff like that. I had a lot of fun with that.
I think they did a lot of again, a lot of references to the Castlevania series with some of their stuff that they put in there. It's cool.
A friend pointed out that their tree for unlocks is not very well designed, and that does hurt the game, I think. But the core game I really like a lot.
I guess for me, the big difference in Rogue Legacy compared to other games like The Binding of Isaac and Risk of Rain is how, when I'm playing Rogue Legacy, once you start playing, your character is pretty much locked in for that run, which is sort of what they did in order to keep it like the Castlevania, almost bullet hell type design of it. But what I like about Binding of Isaac and Risk of Rain is how much your experience can change based on how that run plays out. In Binding of Isaac, for example, I've had runs I felt like I was about ready to restart because I wasn't finding any items, and I found just that one item that turned everything around. Or in Risk of Rain, how so many different strategies can evolve based on how lucky you are or what items are available. A lot of like the healing items, or a lot of like the critical chance items sort of synergize with each other. Glasses that do double damage, you have an item that gives you health back when you do critical hits. So stuff like that that evolves as you play, so it doesn't feel like each run is the exact same way or goes the exact same path, I think adds a lot more to the roguelike genre.
Rana, there's some things that it's so brutal that I hate. Like in Binding of Isaac, where I get like the best item, but I only get one heart container. And then how does it survive with like I'm like this glass cannon pretty much what's happening, and there's some situations where you just have to lose a whole heart. Just it's gonna happen. You don't know what to expect when you jump into a room. Or the opposite, where you just don't find any keys ever, no keys. And there's all these like items you could possibly get.
I've played a bunch of roguelikes, but I'm not like an expert on the genre or anything. I think my first one was Izuna on the original DS, and a lot of my like what makes up the genre to me comes from playing that game first. And I've just learned to accept that in that genre there's going to be, you know, random stuff that screws you. Like in Izuna, you can step on traps that are like the tile doesn't look different until you step on it, and it can totally just kill you. And it's just a thing that you accept when you play that kind of game.
I think
But you also enjoy the replayability, though. That's what it all comes down to, is maybe the next run will be better than the last one.
Right.
I think my first roguelike was, like Rob, for the Game Boy, mine was Shiren the Wanderer.
Yeah, I know the game.
That one, which I think it is done by the same developers who did Azuna.
I didn't actually play it. I just know it exists.
Yep, so I've gotten used to that as well. Now I moved on. I play, Dungeons of Dread more, FTL. Now, Ken, I know we talked about this in previous casts, but you should still really play Dark Souls or Demon Souls these days.
Maybe. There's so much acclaim for it, I just don't want to... I don't know. Maybe I'll pick it up when it's like $5.
I played both of those games. I don't love Dark Souls as much as some other people do. I have a hard time putting my finger on exactly why. But it is... I mean, like I said, I like hard games if I know that they're going to be really hard going in. And it is definitely one of those games that, like, when you die, it's your fault and you know it. So the game doesn't really feel like it cheats.
Yeah, that's one thing I would like. It a genuine challenge, not a cheap challenge, is the way I would go when I pick games like that. So yeah. We'll see. Though I did see some hilarious GIFs of Dark Souls. I just, like, loaded through them. And my favorite, and I described it the other week, where there's one character, he's like a GIF where he's walking up this, like, steep incline, and some skeleton guy, some giant skeleton guy's, like, throwing barrels down or something. And he has to, like, dodge them. And then eventually he's about to run up. He sees him. He's close enough to actually kill him. He runs up. He's about to slice him up. And then some other guy from the side comes over and just kicks him off the ledge. And he dies. I'm like, oh, man.
So a really fundamental part of the experience of that series is the player messages. You can leave messages for each other. But you can't actually communicate directly other than that. So you can see, like, someone might have left, like, a message that says "look out" or something like that. So maybe you know something's coming and you're paying attention and you're expecting some kind of ambush and you get out of it. But you never know if you can trust them. Like, sometimes players will leave, like, there's something below here, off a cliff, then you jump off and you just die.
Or I would just say I would leave messages everywhere saying "be paranoid," so they're always paranoid.
Well, they're all preset messages. You can only say the things that there is a preset for.
Okay.
And speaking of Dark Souls, it'll be interesting to see if it will be able to be viable to play it with, because as we know, Games for Windows Live is going to go down, and Namco Bandai decided to make that their official online architecture for Dark Souls for the PC.
What a mistake. I'm glad that thing is dead. It deserves to die.
I did nothing.
Rotten hell. All it does is double DRMs. That's all it does. I'm like, Steam. Oh, and games online for Windows.
I kind of hope they re-release Demon's Souls for PC, because I really like that game, and if you didn't have a PS3, you missed it.
Yeah, I would also like to play it re-released, because it wasn't very optimized, but the new one's supposed to be optimized for the PC, but I believe it's optimized for the PC because the new architecture for the consoles are PC. I think that's why.
If you have access to a PS3, definitely do give Demon's Souls a look. It's a different game. It doesn't have the whole open world thing. It's got like a hub world and then five separate worlds. But some of those worlds are incredible. The third world is the Tower of Latria, and it is just horrifying the entire time. Just constantly terrified you're going to die.
You know, looking back at the last console generation, I think if I were to pick up my systems, it would definitely be the PS3. I think it had better exclusives overall.
They were both really good.
I don't know. I feel like a lot of the games I got for the 360 came out on the PC.
And there are a few good ones, I would say. Like I wrote the other day, Banjo-Kazooie Nuts and Bolts is still one of my all-time favorites.
I like that game.
Really? Why?
Did you play that game? Because it's not like a standard Banjo-Kazooie game.
Yeah, but that's why people hated it, because it wasn't a standard Banjo-Kazooie game.
I don't know. I've played a lot of 3D platformers. It's nice to have something new.
It pretty much did the whole Terraria or Minecraft, you build whatever you want type thing before those games came out. And it did it also with allowing you to basically figure out these solutions to these puzzles pretty much on your own time. Like, you didn't need to follow a guide. I've had a case where I just built vehicles exclusively for just that one challenge. I just broke that challenge or that one vehicle. And it was awesome that the game had the tool set and the functionality to let me do that.
I feel like I trivialized a lot of that stuff. I was just like, well, guess I'm just going to build a helicopter.
You guys are strange. Because I remember Nuts and Bolts being such a giant disappointment. People were just upset about that game, because when it came out, they first released a trailer. And it looked like Banjo-Kazooie, like HD, beautiful fur, all this stuff like that. and they released it as like a parody joke on what it was, and then they released Cars, and you didn't expect that. You know, it's kind of like, you know, you're playing, and I guess it's not really a joke as much, but you're playing like a Mario game, and suddenly it turns into an action-based role-playing grid-based farm simulator. You wouldn't expect that, right?
I think the problem that they had was they kind of did go against the brand of Banjo-Kazooie. Because as you said, expected it to be a platform.
Anytime
that you update a property and you don't do exactly the same thing, people are going to be upset about it.
Yeah,
I didn't feel like it was deceptive in any way. I knew what I was getting into.
Yeah. It still seems deceptive. I was looking at the promotional material for it once before the game came out.
Okay.
Like all their videos, like hyping it up, it all looked like it was going to be a platformer directly.
Huh.
And nuts and bolts was going to be, and like they barely used Kazooie in it. it was just Banjo and a bunch of like nuts and bolt cars. I understand they were trying to go for it, but I feel like again, it was mismarketed.
I think
I think it hurt the brand horribly because of that.
I didn't actually play the first Banjo Kazooie until then because it got re-released on Live Arcade around the same time.
Uh-huh.
I did really like it. I'm not sure that. No, I had a lot of fun, but I think the genre has moved on.
Mm-hmm. I think it was a big slap in the face you put at the beginning of the game because they make fun of the collecting thing that you had to do in the first game. Like, they were talking down to people. It's kind of like in that Devil May Cry, the new version of the Devil May Cry, and we'll talk about last week in detail. But there was a scene where Dante gets like a mop on his head because his hair's black now, and he's like, not in a million years, right? Talking about like, they're saying like, oh, we're sticking to our choices, but if you read it as a devoted fan, you're like, this is a slap in the face. They're just making fun of us now. Why would you do that?
So I understand I haven't seen the new one, but I would think that's more. I would have read that totally the opposite. I would have thought to myself, that's like a quick wink to those of us who played before.
And as a spoiler warning, his hair does become gray by the end of it for real. Like the final minute of the game, he gets the silver gray hair.
Spoiling it. But that's what I'm saying. Like that kind of, even though they're trying to be like tongue in cheek about it and trying to like be, well, we're a parody of what this was or something like that. It doesn't come off that way, you know? It's the way you frame it. And the way they framed it was more of an insulting, derogatory way to the fans. So I guess it all depends on how you do it. I think they just cut that scene out and they would have been fine. No controversy.
I'm going to have to take your word for it because I can't see how they could possibly be insulting.
Yeah, no. So the reason why it'd be insulting is because there's such an outrage, right, about it. Everyone's making such a big deal about his hair not being white. It's like, oh, it's not the same game. His hair's not white. We're like, it's such a stupid thing, and the developer thought it was a stupid thing. But like, by making that kind of comment, they're not only addressing like, yeah, we saw the issue, but we don't care.
I've changed my opinion. I now think it is insulting and that those people need it insulting.
Yeah, they would have just kept it out. It would have been fine. And we'd be like, oh, this is a great game. You changed my mind. Yeah, I think you made the right choice. But saying that, you're like, well, you insulted me.
I did.
And I'll enjoy this game less.
One way or the other, like when we talked with Pete last week.
But we're not hardcore fans of the game, though. Like hardcore, like I'm talking about like from day one of Devil May Cry. Like I'm not that like that. But if there was a series that I loved and beholded for many, many years and they did something like that, I'd be insulted, you know? And I would think less of the game for it, even though the game was good. But people don't have to be rational with their what they enjoy and whatever. So there's that. And the Banjo-Kazooie was worse with the way they did it. Because they're like, we're showing you something new. But again, you guys really love the game. And I only played bits and pieces of it through, it's funny because it's got nuts and bolts, but bits and pieces of it through demos and stuff like that. And
well, since I didn't play the first one, I don't have the same baggage when I come to it.
Yeah, I think that's it. I think it's the same way with Josh with his like love of DMC because he did play the originals. So he's just picking up fresh and it seems really great.
I did play the originals. I played all of them.
Oh, well, there you go.
I played the original late, so.
Yeah, I play a lot of originals that go late, like Baldur's Gate 2.
You played that late, you played that early, you played that everywhere in between. Yeah.
Yes, we'll talk about that when we're talking about games.
I guess moving away from the tangent, going back to the Kickstarter, right now, according to this, they have met their goal. And I think what we were talking about before the cast was interesting, and how one of their stretch goals is to add basically a playable female character.
I think it's actually, to me, it sounds like bad English, but the way they
said it, because
it's like, playable female character, $600,000, double the goal. And what they're trying to, all they're trying to say, if you read the description, is that we'll just add another quest line and you can play a female character, which is fine. But they're making it, but the way they're phrasing it, it makes it sound like it's like an achievement that a girl could be a character in the game.
Even the way you said it now doesn't make it real clear. What they said is you're going to make a new quest line where you play as an alternate character who is saving the main character.
Sure, right.
Yeah.
And she's smart, courageous, and good at stealth. So there's a couple things that could go into that. But yeah, it just seems a bit, you know, derogatory. But I think what I see was derogatory is it says playable female character and then 600,000 next to it.
But, yeah, the initial headline isn't great.
Yeah.
Yeah, it costs a double what the game goal is to make a female character.
And there's of course that piece a few weeks ago when I think the Arma developers announced that they couldn't figure out a way to get female models to drive cars or fly helicopters or something like that.
Oh, that's a really messed up thing to say.
I don't remember the exact word, but they didn't want to have female characters in the game because they couldn't figure out where. There was some kind of hurdle with trying to have women drive the cars or fly any of the vehicles.
What? That seems sounds like a BS reason. And it fits into a stereotype of girls can't drive, which is, they're doubling down right there. They're like, well, we couldn't have Asians or females in the game because we couldn't get into vehicles. It's racism.
Okay. Now, keeping with Kickstarter, Rob, since this is your first time on, I do have a few questions I like to ask everyone who comes on regarding their thoughts on Kickstarter and Early Access.
Sure.
So I guess the first one is, we've had people on discussing about the merits and the problems with Kickstarter. So my first question for you, Rob, is what are your thoughts on crowdfunding in general? Do you see it as a positive step forward? Do you have reservations or somewhere completely different?
I think there's ups and downs to it. I mean, it can make some projects happen that would never happen otherwise. There's a couple issues with it. I mean, it's a fundamentally trust-based model, right? You pledge this money. If you then get nothing, you know, you're up the creek. Not much you can do about it. And there are also questions about whether something really needs to be crowdfunded versus a budget. But I mean, if someone wants to crowdfund a thing instead of funding it up front, I don't really, it might rub me personally the wrong way if I don't feel like they need it. But there's nothing really wrong with it. There's no reason that, like, if EA wants to kickstart a game, you know, who cares?
Yeah. Building on top of that, there's also the debate on early access. And this is one that we're hearing a lot from these days. Well, with basically how it's pretty much put the whole profit structure of a video game in reverse. Normally,
right, it front loads it.
Yeah. Yeah, just as you said. So this has also led to that debate that should these developers be profiting that early from a game? Some people view it as, you know, hey, if they want to sell it and people want to buy it, let them. Rob, what are your thoughts on early access? Are you as positive about as you're about Kickstarter, or are your thoughts different?
Well, again, there's ups and downs. And lots of people like being able to play things early. But I mean, things get put into early access that are in no way ready for prime time. And I don't really want to normalize paying to, like, alpha test things. I made exceptions, but I basically don't do betas anymore. Because even when they're free, I spend my time playing a game that is at least theoretically inferior to the final game. And then by the time the real thing comes out, I'm bored with it. Yeah. I don't want to play it anymore. I ruined Torchlight 2 for myself, not because it's a bad game, because it's not. I ruined that game for myself by playing so much of the beta that when the real game came out, I just didn't want to play anymore.
And the exact same way I did that with Drox Operative from Soldag. I played the beta of that, and by the time the game was out, I just felt completely drained on that. I didn't actually play the game again until, ironically, they did the beta for their expansion, and that was when I started to play the full game again.
I think for me, Path of Exile was the game that I played too much of the beta of. Because 6-year beta, how could you not play all of it? And now they released it on Steam, and I downloaded it again, and I'm like, do I want to do this? And I said no.
And I mean, we basically, I've lost track of how many hours we spent playing that in hardcore mode. I think I've got the entire Act 1 memorized now, every blade of grass in that.
That was actually part of my problem with Torchlight. I played through the beta was all of Episode 1, I think, right? When there was just a beta, I played through Episode 1 with all four of the classes. And then when the real game came out, I think I couldn't import the character. Maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think I could. So I would have had to play through Act 1 again. And I started it, and I was like, you know what? I think I'm done with this. I'm good. I've played an adequate amount of Torchlight 2.
Yeah, I mean, you basically see everything that you really need to see for that game, and then pretty much they to start back again at zero just feels like, I already saw all this, so why should I do it all again?
Right. If I could have started where I had left off, I think I would have had a better time with it. And I mean, I don't blame the game. I blame myself. Yeah. I should not have done that.
Yeah, same for me with Drox Operative. And I'm hearing Blarsor being like that with Starbound. There's people who want to play it, but then there's, of course, the fact that they've wiped the characters twice, and the game has still got, I think I've heard, like another year or two in terms of development for them to keep adding and building towards.
Well, okay, so there's a lot of people that are angry about like early access, and then I feel like there's a lot more stuff going against it now of recent because there's so many early access games that are top sellers on the Steam store. But I think it's fair for them to do it if they clearly say it's early access. If they don't,
yeah.
I think that's bad. Like, what is it? Freaking War Z? Kind of crap. That needs to not be there.
So DayZ, not Warzy, but DayZ, I think did a good job with that. Like they were very upfront.
Yeah, real
this is an alpha.
Yeah, I think that is like the big factor. I mean, when you say on your thing, this is an alpha, do not buy this if you want to complete a game, then I think if someone buys it, they do waive the right to complain, saying, why isn't the game done?
It's completely fair. Like if I were to say like, oh, there's a horrible glitch from DayZ, I'm like, well, it's alpha, so okay. You deal with it.
I guess that's basically my position on early access. Like, there's no reason not to do it. I get the motivations. I get the reasons for doing it. But I think not for me.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's a preference and taste, too. Unless you really love the game, like, a lot. Like, you really love what it's about, and you really want to give it your first shot, you want to get as early as possible, then sure, you can do it that way, too. Yeah. Like, if Dreamfall was all like, guys, we're going to give you an alpha build, like, way, way early, I'm like, yes. Yes, I want to right now, because I just love that series so much.
Yeah, and I think another for me is I'm fine with paying for an alpha or paying for early access if it's on sale, or if I know that if I'm going to enjoy this game, but, you know, it's got time, I can buy it for 50-75% off, and then, you know, just let it sit in my library, and, you know, like a good wine, let it age until it gets to the point that I'm ready to then sit down and play it.
I don't usually do that, but I've done it once or twice. I'm actually doing that right now with Sir, You Are Being Hunted.
Yeah, I did.
Oh, yeah. That's one of those games I really want to try out.
I actually did fire it up briefly, and it's neat, although it's rough.
Yeah.
But mostly I bought it because it was on sale, and I really want to play the finish one when it's done.
Yeah, and I did that with Prison Architect, but I waited for it to be, I think, with my Steam currency and the sale. I think I got for like $14, $15. I felt that was a fair enough price away for a game of that low, because I think it would go down any more than that, even when it was released.
In that way, it's kind of like Kickstarter, right? Yeah. You're not buying it for what it is now. You're buying it because you want it to happen, and you want the finished product.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a funny way of looking at it, but yeah. You know, it's talking about the couple weeks ago, we talked about cards and my obsession with cards. Mm-hmm. That's what I do now, too, is I try to sell as much stuff as possible, play as many games that I own on my library, so I can then use it to buy things like Banner Saga. I got for $10 instead of $24 because of all the credit I had. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I sold a hat on TF2 and I sold for $10. Yeah. $10 hat, by the way.
Yeah,
sold
I'm
it.
Stuck selling, you know, 10 cent cards.
That's items.
Cards, dude, that's where I am, too, and the result is that I just don't sell anything.
Just get some TF2, play TF2, and you get dropped items or you get specialized strange. We should
and
play.
I play TF2, and then I get things that are worth like a penny.
Yeah,
and
nothing.
I have a lot of them, and together they might be worth a bunch. But I just can't.
I'm sure you can sell all those crates, all those useless crates.
Yeah, I haven't logged into TF2 in like 2 years, or I think the last time I played was when Man vs. Machine was first released. That was my last time I played TF2.
Oh, and that's changed a lot too, by the way, MBM.
I started playing it again recently, and I have a server that I've played on for a while, and I love that server. It's fantastic. People play the game seriously. It's not a trading server or anything, but like everyone's friendly, all talks on. And I was gone for like a couple of years, I think, and I came back and I changed Steam names, like people change hats like all the time. And one of the admins remembered me based on my avatar.
Nice.
Never changed, and that was awesome.
Yeah, and for me, for my server, I played on for so many years that I'm now ranked like 70th on the server of 100 some thousand. And, you know, I also am a VIP, so my text is all special and blue, and I pay for that monthly. Even when I don't play, I still pay for it monthly because I love the community. People are really cool there, and the regulars are really cool. The non-regulars are real dumb. That's just how games are sometimes. But when I say really dumb, I mean the normal people you expect to be on an FPS game
right.
is there. But don't worry, because we're cool enough to take away their vitriol or whatever. Like, we just lull out their insults.
All right, and Rob, one last question for you regarding Kickstarter and Early Access. And this is another one that we've gotten some debates about with previous guests. And that is the viability of Kickstarter as a platform. As we've seen, Kickstarter has blown up thanks to Double Fine, Stowaway, Uber, and so on. But there's also the fact that there's been a lot of projects that have also failed or haven't met the expectations. So a lot of people are calling the question, can Kickstarter or just crowdfunding in general remain viable as an option as opposed to publisher or self-funding? In your opinion, what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, this is going to be kind of off the cuff because I don't have a clearly formulated position. But I think Kickstarter in that sense is kind of the Wild West, right? Like, you do your research. Maybe you kick back this thing, not just because you want what it's going to be, but because, like, the person doing it has a history and you trust them. Like, I mean, if I back something by Double Fine, I might like the result. I might not like the result, but they're going to publish something.
Okay.
And I mean, if you're going to get into something that's so speculative, I think you'd have to be willing to accept that risk.
Yeah, man.
I don't think it's Kickstarter itself being the only viable format. I think there's a lot of different things that allow you to do crowdfunding. I think crowdfunding is now a legit way of getting a product created or funded or get eyes on the project. I think that's definitely a new option over just being published through publisher or self-funding.
So, I'm a little concerned about the stampede to Kickstarter.
That's what you're always going to get with new formats. Like, just in general, like, independent game development, like, everyone and their mother wants to be an independent game developer, but not everyone's going to make it. It all depends on, you know, your idea, your marketing, your presence, et cetera, et cetera. But it also creates a lot of really interesting, weird things, like the concept of an indie superstars that arise, like Phil Fish, who went crazy and left. But that's going to happen. That's a new thing. Like, because we're so interconnected with all our social media, but now all these introverted, like, game devs with some really, how would you say, controversial opinions, you know, get railed against, and every mistake is scrutinized by, like, millions of people. Not everyone can handle that, and I think that's what game devs are trying to learn, too. So it's an interesting world.
Yeah, we're definitely entering a really interesting era for the game industry, just in how much digital distribution and just our online identity and just online in general has changed the scope of development. I mean, we've seen 10, maybe even 5 years ago, unless you were part of a developer studio, you weren't going to make a game. Or if you work on a mega game, it would be like this $3 thing you would find maybe on like a flashlight somewhere. Now, thanks to tools like Unity, crowdfunding, you get a few guys together who are somewhat expert in their field or good at programming, and you could make a game that could make thousands of dollars or even put yourselves on the map.
Yeah, and I think it's super cool with how close the devs are. Like, again, I always talk good, and we haven't actually got him to come on the cast, but Dave Gilbert from the Blackwell Legacy and Wadjet Eye Games is super cool on his forums. Like, I make a one singular question, the first person to respond is Dave himself. I'm like, Dave, and you're messaging me directly?
Yeah. And
I do it again. He does it directly, a direct response again. I'm like, that's amazing. Yeah. I can directly talk to him.
And that right there is a very great strength of the indie developers. When you're talking to a guy when you're talking to someone like someone makes Blackwell or Dungeon of Dreadmore, or even something like when I talk to Vic Davis from Cryptic Comet, I'm talking to the actual guy who's making it. I'm not sending an email to a press company that will then send it to the press line of another company where there's like 3-4 employees. I'm usually talking to the guy who sat there and designed that game.
Yeah, I actually reported a display bug for Cook Serve Delicious, which is amazing, by the way.
Yeah.
You should all buy that.
Yeah, Cook. We have. Actually, one of our first posts
I wrote
on the new game Wisdom was,
I love that.
I reported a display bug, and I got an email back from the developer, like, the next day. Mm-hmm. That was pretty neat. There's actually a really interesting post-mortem
Maybe that's the wrong word, actually. But he wrote up his experience with Steam sales. That's worth a read.
Oh, yeah. There's a lot of – I always love reading those articles about how things like the Defenders – what's it called? Valley Defenders?
Dungeon Defenders?
No. It's –
Defense Grid?
It has like a girl wizard in the beginning of it. They made it for Linux, too. It's like – it's like a tower defense game where you have like little RPG characters.
I know what you're thinking, but
there's like a berserker in it. That's the first guy
it's
you
not
get.
Dungeon Defenders.
No, it's 2D.
I know what desktop dungeons.
No, not top dungeons. I love how we're doing this. The guessing game of what
I'm like googling keywords trying to figure out what this is. I have no idea.
Oh, I'll look it up right now. We're gonna do it. We'll take time out of the cast for a second. It's dungeon something.
Somebody play maybe elevator music.
All right, I'll play some Soul Bossa Nova. I think it's called. Actually, Dungeons. It's Defenders. Something Defenders. Defenders Quest. I found it. It's Defenders Quest Valley of the Forgotten.
I have no idea what that is.
Really?
Oh, there it is.
Yeah.
It's a pretty fun game. It's one of those few indie games actually fully beat the whole thing because it was so
addictive. I see it here. There's a Steam Linux sale thing on Gamasutra. Is that what you're thinking?
Yeah, yeah. That's the one, right. You talked about, with the spotlight on Linux, what happened to his game and how many sales he actually got from it. It was a pretty interesting read, plus I did enjoy the game.
The Cookshare of Delicious guy said that he made other games before that basically didn't sell more than a few copies. And he was kind of thinking that Cookshare of Delicious was going to do similarly. So he wasn't his first big thing was getting into a Humble Bundle. Before that, he was using this payment company called BMT Micro, I think, who are actually I bought the game when they were there and it was fine, but it's not exactly suitable for reaching a mass audience.
And I know Cryptic Comet uses BMT Micro too for their games.
Yeah. So, I mean, as a payment service, it's totally fine. Yeah. I have no problems with them. But getting into the Humble Bundle was the first big press. And then when he got greenlit, he tried to, he agreed to participate in a Steam sale. He tried to, make everybody happy. I know I appreciated this. When he got greenlit on Steam, they gave out Steam keys to everyone who had bought it before. And nice. That goodwill really did, at least for me. I got a bunch of people to buy it. I bought a couple copies for people.
That reminds me of why for Consortium, there was a Kickstarter project called Consortium, and they were gracious enough to give Steam keys along with their DRM-free, because, again, the Steam keys, they usually make cards for those games, so instead of just playing a DRM-free, you get cards too while you play it. It's a double win. Everyone wins. Yeah, and you have it in your Steam library forever, and you can't lose it.
Yeah, I think this is even dumber than the Steam cards thing, but the big thing for me is that almost all of my gaming goes through Steam, and it's just really nice to have everything there.
Yeah. Exactly. And again, I bought La Malana. Sorry, I have it somewhere. I got it for $1, but then I just left the EXE somewhere, and I just never installed it, and I got a new computer, and now it's just gone forever. I don't know where I bought it, so
it was
I'm
just
never
like a
finding
buck,
that again.
It was just $1.50.
Exactly.
On Steam.
It's like me buying a really disgusting hot dog.
It was just on sale a couple days ago.
Yep, oh, okay.
I did the same thing with Cooks Are Delicious that I bought when it first came out, and I couldn't find my key or I didn't know what to do. And I sent him an email and I got a response, I think, literally within the hour saying, "Oh, I found you. Here's your key. Enjoy." And it's such a great thing to be able to talk to these developers. And a lot of these guys are really decent people. So it's great to be able to interact with them.
I had that experience with the guys who made Aquaria. They were also very, very in touch. I mean, it's easier when you're a small company or it's, a guy and you have a small community, but it is really nice.
No, it's actually talking about internet personalities too, or developers and their internet personas and stuff. I remember, during the Mass Effect 3 debacle with the ending, and everyone was on forums raging out of control. The original writer for Dragon Age and Mass Effect 1 and 2 came out. He just said he got out of the industry and started writing books and made his comments about the ending and what he's heard about it and described how he would have, what maybe have gone through. And then everyone went praising him as a saint and said, "I'll buy whatever you make." He would make the talk of so much sense. And I'm like, oh man, if you're talking about PR move, he made the best PR move he could possibly make right there at that very moment.
Yeah, we've been making fun of SimCity, and I think we all agree that if Tilted Mill just were able to get a Medieval Mayor out just as SimCity 5 was breaking apart, it probably would have sold gangbusters.
Definitely, gangbusters. It's insane how much, it's all about timing too. But yeah. And I think I actually wanted to discuss this earlier about when we start talking about this, is I actually buy games based on developers' reputation. Too not only about what I hear, but what I see from them. Like, I know Phil Fish made Fez, and everyone loves Fez, and it's beautiful, and it's artistic. But he, and again, well, he's out of the industry now, so I can say whatever, but he came off as really douchey. He said some really, what would you say?
He said Japanese games.
Yeah, very controversial things, you know? Mm-hmm. And he's saying all this, and he has an Andy Kaufman icon for his Twitter. So, like, there's even more reason for me to just, like, see what he's trying to do, trying to get a rise out of people. But I don't want my developer to be like that. I don't want to fund a guy that makes those kind of statements. We talked about the separation of game and developer, but to me, in this new age of independence, I think that they're, like, one and the same, right?
Yeah, and that's an interesting point. There was this developer who, he was a guy who did the Neverhood, and I think he did Earthworm Jim, and then people were going to fund his latest game. Then war broke out about how he's very homophobic, and I think someone else, and a lot of people were just turned off by that. And as you said, it can be very hard to separate the game from the guy who's making the game these days.
Who's that guy that made Eternal Darkness or whatever? He did a lot of dickish things.
Eternal Darkness, the GameCube one with the Sanity?
Yeah.
The company,
Dennis Dyack. Yeah.
Yeah, that guy. I funded the Kickstarter because it seemed like a cool idea. All the comments were about how much he was a jerk and a sexist and a bunch of other stuff about him. I'm like, what? I didn't know the history.
I really liked Eternal Darkness.
They got funded. They tried to go through Kickstarter twice and failed twice.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean,
and the CEO of the new company got arrested for child pedophilia or something like that. Something like that. Which is even worse. So, like, you had, like, that one infamous designer that no one likes, and then you got the CEO gang going to jail for pedophilic charges. So, together,
I remember game was doomed to fail. Silicon Knights. I remember, like, the crap they went through with that X-Men game. I remember Human bombing.
Two Human. Horribly. Jesus. That's like another Duke Nukem forever.
What was the X-Men thing?
It was X-Men, I think, Legends, or... I
mean, No.
I played X-Men Legends. X-Men Legends was good.
It's not Legends. It's like
here we go.
X-Men's First Generation.
It was like Destiny?
Destiny, yeah. X-Men Destiny, I think that's what it was called.
I only know the headline. I have no idea.
It was a game where you didn't play the X-Men, and you played, like, pre-made characters or whatever. Like, make your own characters, but they weren't really your characters, just pre-made sets, and all the powers were really generic.
And it was just, like, very horrible looking, the game didn't play right, and Kotaku wrote a whole report about it, that the whole game was just, the development was like a hell, that they were, you know, not working on it. I think one of the rumors that they were using the funding they got from X-Men Legends, they use that, or X-Men Destiny, my mistake, to fund another game that they were working on.
And that sounds like Gearbox, actually, with Aliens.
Oh, but, I didn't hear about that.
Yeah, it's a rumor, it's not real. But the rumor was that, because Aliens Colonial Marines was so bad, it's such a big lie from what the trailer showed, their teaser, whatever, for E3, that they said that the money that was funneled to Borderlands 2, is what they said. That was probably a falsity, but it is a rumor.
Wow.
But again, just going back to, like, controversial stuff, like, statements, one of the most, I hated this statement, but when Phil Fish got in an argument with the beer guy from Game Trailers, he said, "Look at your life and look at mine and kill yourself." I'm like, wow, you're going to say that to someone? Hell no, I'll never buy your games. In fact, I will go on a parade to tell everyone not to buy your game. I don't care how artsy it is. You don't say something like that to someone, you know?
So
arrogance. What? Go ahead.
I only played, like, maybe half an hour of Fez, I think a little less. Is there some point at which it becomes amazing? Because I didn't see it.
I didn't see it either.
It's supposed to be like, people are like, it's life-changing. You'll see things in a different light. Like, it's like the holy grail of indie games. I'm like, I don't see it.
Yeah.
I've seen bits of it, late of it, and I don't find it that amazing. I think it had an interesting concept.
I think mechanically it was interesting.
Right.
But I didn't find it... Mm-hmm. I didn't see it as mind-blowing. It felt very basic and... It definitely had some pacing issues with how you had to backtrack through a lot of the puzzles, and I think a lot of it was just complexity for complexity's sake with a lot of the more, I guess, higher-level puzzles. I remember hearing that you had to scan barcodes or scan the little tags that solve certain puzzles, and I didn't feel the need to do all that. I didn't feel motivated to play that game all the way through to 100%.
Yeah, I mean, talking about indie games making bigger impacts, like in that movie, Indie Game the Movie, I feel like Binding of Isaac made a much bigger impact on me, because it turned me onto roguelike games forever. Like, I got addicted to those runs, and I played hours and hours of that game. And I've read meanings into it. Like, all the monsters have their own meanings in the environment and the weapons and all that stuff. Has its own kind of, like, stories of abuse tied into it, which I loved. Well, I think Fez was just too, I don't know, was trying to make a statement that was just too, what would you call it, pompous for my own good. But again, I think maybe that's more tied into my dislike of that guy over the game itself, right? And again, it's more of those things, like, you could argue all day long that you should separate the developer and the game, but listen, if you're going to buy the game, you're supporting that developer, like, directly. And I don't want to support that developer, and I don't care how good the game is, I'm not going to play it, and that's it. Unless I get free.
I was pretty disconnected from the controversy. I barely know what he said. I barely know anything about the guy. I just wasn't impressed by what I played at the game, which admittedly wasn't much.
So now you're double downing because the game is not impressive and the guy is really douchey. So,
and the fact that it didn't take like 8 or 9, it took like a long time for him to make that game, right?
6 years. And he won. He actually, what messed me up, pissed me off is the IGF gave him 2 awards 2 years in a row. Mm-hmm. Why? Another developer could have gotten it. Why does he need 2 awards for that game?
Yeah, I thought Gunpoint did things. It was a lot more innovative, and I really enjoyed that more than I did Fez, even though it was a vastly smaller experience.
I like Gunpoint a lot.
I think it beat Gone Home, too, which is sad. Talk about an indie game that I liked. It wasn't like, but that, at the end, that was not a mechanically heavy game, though.
Yeah.
I liked Gone Home, but not as much as I think other people did.
Yeah, me too.
I feel like it has a lot of hate for it, though, because it's too short.
And I think the price, I think, rubbed a lot of people the wrong way.
To me, like,
I got it on sale, or maybe as a gift.
To me, it was a different, like, I wanted a different kind of game. That's what I expect from independent games, because even though you like platformers, I like a variety to my indie games, and a lot of them become platformers.
Yeah, I play a lot of indie games, because I think I mentioned earlier, I don't have the attention span for a lot of AAA games anymore.
Yeah.
Except for those old RPGs, I'm coming back and trying those out because, again, I was either too young for it or didn't understand it when I was younger. So I'm trying, and I'll talk about that during games I'm trying this week.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, I think with that, that'll be a good point to segue on.